I have loved studying the Quarry of Ours, especially during the year of priests, and an incredible scene happened in May of 1845, when one morning John Vianney mounted his pulpit and he saw sitting out in the pews with the chatelaine of ours, La Cordière, and he felt intimidated to preach. He felt that he was the lowest of the low and La Cordière was the highest of the high. But and after La Cordière had preached Vespers, he trembled to go back to that same pulpit. But a short time thereafter, when La Cordière was speaking to a group of priests just like ours, some flippant priest said, "You mustn't have been very impressed with Father Vianney's eloquence or lack thereof." And La Cordière said in response, "He preaches like a good pastor should. He and I might not speak the same language, the same terminology, but we do try to cover the same themes." I think that that's more of a canonization of La Cordière than St. John Vianney. But when I was setting up the seminar, I wanted to expand us beyond the English-speaking world to get someone who would be able to speak on a particular context of the church at various times in preaching, as well as the church in difficult structures. And La Cordière preached at a time in France when we really needed preachers, not only to rebuild the faith of the people, but also rebuild the fiber of the nation. And I had met Father Peter Batts before, because we have mutual friends who are Dominican nuns in Summit, New Jersey, but I actually didn't know he was the English-speaking world's greatest La Cordière scholar. So when I contacted my Dominican friends about who could speak, they said, "Peter Batts is the guy that you want." And so he was over in France where he's been working on a book on La Cordière and preaching. He's going to share with us his insights. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on Father La Cordière. He's a priest of the St. Joseph province, the eastern province of the Dominican See, was ordained in 1981. So Father Peter Batts teaches theology at Providence College, and now he teaches us.
Father Roger just stole my opening story. Sorry. That was my story. I must apologize. I am recovering laryngitis. I have laryngitis today, so you'll have to excuse this. But anyway, I'll try to do as best I can with this thing. Anyway.
Is it better?
It's better. If I mention the word La Cordière, what comes to mind? Does anybody want to say?
Drinking.
What?
Drinking.
The abstinence society.
Abstinence, yes.
Why? I've never understood that.
You ask me.
I lived in Ottawa for 3 years, and I heard that the abstinence society is called the La Cordière Society. There is nothing in his life that would indicate drinking problems.
Judge the plot.
Yes.
The beautiful prayer, the priest is forever.
Yeah, the beautiful prayer about the priest. Now, I must tell you, there is no French version of that prayer. No French Dominican has ever heard of that prayer. None. So we think that probably at the end of the 19th century, some pious English-speaking person made up that prayer and attributed it to La Cordière. I've asked all kinds of French Dominican scholars on La Cordière, and they look at me like they've never heard of anything like that. But everybody's going to have to change their ordination cards and all of that. Okay, there'll be three segments to this. The first part is a brief biography of La Cordière. A brief biography. Then I want to look at some principal themes of his thought. Some of the principal ideas that motivate him, especially in his preaching. And finally, I want to look at some specific aspects of his preaching. First, the biographical things. He is undoubtedly the greatest preacher in 19th century France. He's one of the greatest preachers in the 19th century. And I think his only real rival for being the greatest preacher would be John Henry Cardinal Newman. born near Dijon, France in 1802. Now, that was a very difficult time to be born in a Catholic world, because this is after the French Revolution. And if you remember, the French Revolution at its worst tried to destroy the Catholic Church. So he's born into a Catholic Church that is just in the process of being restored. There is almost no religious education. He himself received almost no religious education. So he comes from a family that is Catholic. His mother was somewhat pious. It was a bourgeois family of doctors and lawyers. He got a good education. And when he was 12 years old, he received the sacrament of Holy Communion and penance, which was normal for the time. And he says that that was his last religious experience for many years, that receiving communion at 12 years old. Because from that point on, he became rather alienated from the Catholic Church. He was a brilliant student. He was sent off to a lycée, a very good lycée. And he had this teacher who influenced him very much. The teacher was an unbeliever. But the teacher was very much imbued with the ideals of the French Revolution, with liberty, equality, and fraternity. And Lagardère bought into his unbelief, but he also bought into his love of the ideals of the revolution. And for the rest of his life, Lagardère would have this very deep love of the ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity, even as a Catholic. Lagardère was very much a romantic. Romanticism was very popular during that time. And ironically, Romanticism was what brought many people into the Catholic Church in the early 19th century. So he very much emphasized the heart. In any case, he went on to law school in Dijon. And when he was in law school, he met this group of Catholics. There was a Catholic group that he, those people that he met. And he was very much influenced by them. And so he became much more open to the Catholic Church, much more open to Catholic teachings, and really reconsidered much of his previous life. When he was 23 years old, he converted to Catholicism, and that's how he referred to it, as a conversion. He always saw himself as a convert. Even though he'd been baptized as a child, he had, for the most part, been raised without Catholicism, had that one beautiful experience when he was 12, and that was it for years and years. So he has this conversion experience. He was a law clerk in Paris, and he describes it this way. I wept, then I believed. I wept, then I believed. That is the typical romantic conversion to Catholicism. You find it in Chateaubriand, you find it in a number of others. Not that they reason themselves into the church, but they wept. Their heart somehow is won over by the gospel, and then their reason or their mind follows. And that was the way he saw his conversion. Now, he was the kind of person who didn't do halfway measures. So once he decided to become a Catholic, he had to become a priest. No, his mother was not too happy about that. She was one of these ambitious mothers. She was a widow. His father died when he was 4. And she had followed him to Paris. She was hoping that her son would have this brilliant career. And even though she was a believer, somewhat pious, she still wasn't quite comfortable when he announced he was going to become a priest. But anyway, he entered the seminary in Paris. And he immediately ran into problems in the seminary, because the authorities said, he's different than the others. Now, this is after the French Revolution. There's not a lot of gain at this point in becoming a priest. So you have a different kind of young man becoming a priest than you have had before the Revolution. They were very, very pious. They were not from upper classes for the most part. And the prototypical priesthood candidate at that time would have been John Vianney, the Curé of Ars. Not necessarily the brightest guys in the world, but very good holy priests. priest, very much concerned about serving the church and people. They didn't trust Lackordaire. You got this very well-educated lawyer. He's liberal, even though he certainly wouldn't justify the excesses of the French Revolution. He accepts the ideals. He accepts liberty, equality, fraternity. He sounds like our enemies. And so the authorities didn't quite know what to do about this. And they thought about throwing him out of the seminary. Well, the Archbishop of Paris wasn't going to have this. Because this is the biggest catch he's had in a long time. And Lackordaire knows how to play his cards. He threatens to join the Jesuits. He wants to join the Jesuits if they don't ordain him. And so the Archbishop ordains him. He's ordained as a priest of the Archdiocese of Paris in 1827. Now, they had all kinds of ambitions for him. Some were in Paris, some of their plans. Others were in Rome. He wanted no part of it. He wanted to just be a simple priest. So his first assignments were as chaplaincies in convents and in girls' schools. And one of the things he liked about these kinds of assignments is that they gave him a lot of time to study. Because he's one of those people who was in some ways self-educated. Even though he had received the seminary education, it was not enough for him. So he's very much concerned about studying St. Augustine, studying St. Thomas Aquinas, and just really getting as much theological knowledge as he could. So he tried to turn down any offers that were made that were really prestigious kinds of things. But he was excited by one thing. Now, this man loved liberty. And if you loved liberty at the beginning of the 19th century, where would you look as the ideal place to go? The United States. And so he dreamed of coming to the United States. The Bishop of New York at the time was a Dominican. Well, maybe he was a Dominican. There were several of those early bishops worked. He was a Frenchman. We do know that. He was a Frenchman. And he wanted Lackordaire to come to New York. He said he could be rector of the seminary. He could be vicar general. He could be anything he wanted if he came to New York. And Lackordaire was all prepared to come to New York, the great land of liberty. But then, around 1829 or so, he ran into this priest named Félicité Lamennais. Unfortunately, I should have given you some sort of handouts, or if I had a blackboard or so, I would write these things down. But anyway, Félicité Lamennais was this priest, very, very romantic. Like Lackordaire, he too had wept and then believed. But he was this kind of a strange sort. Like he said, for example, he never really wanted to be a priest. But he did become a priest. He claims he was kind of forced to be a priest. And he said that the day he was ordained to the priesthood was the most unhappy day of his life. Unlike your father. And we don't know if he ever said Mass in his whole life. We just don't know. But anyway, he was an ultramontanist. And he had gathered a group of young men around him. And he wanted to sort of tutor them in his various ultramontanist views and other views. He wanted the Pope to be the head of Europe. He had a very high regard for the Pope. He thought the Pope was really the only European leader who had any credibility given the new world that had come out of the Revolution. And he also wanted, and this is where Lackordaire found very attractive, he wanted to reconcile God and liberty. That was the great project of Lamennais, which Lackordaire found very attractive. Lackordaire had a kind of initial dislike for Lamennais. He didn't trust him at the beginning, and he felt as time went on that he had good reason for not trusting him. But anyway, they joined together in this movement for God and liberty. And they started a newspaper called L'Avenir, which is the French word for the future. And a whole movement came about as a result of this. And this Lavenir movement stressed separation of church and state. It stressed the modern freedoms, freedom of education, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, etc. And it fought especially for educational freedom, because at that point in French history, there was a lot of difficulty in running Catholic schools. The state wanted to control all education. So Lavenir had to have various court appeals and that sort of thing. So it was a big issue. So he became very much involved. And it was a very controversial movement, this Lavenir movement. And it was distrusted by secular liberals because their attitude was, why would Catholics want freedom? There's something wrong here. We don't trust them. And the Catholics said, why would Catholics want freedom? We don't trust them either. Meanwhile, the priests, a lot of them didn't like the idea of separation of church and state, because since the revolution, the priests worked civil servants. They received their salaries from the state. Lavenir said, as long as you receive your salaries from the state, you are somehow dependent on the state and you are not truly free. If you want to be truly free, turn the salary back, don't accept it. Well, the clergy didn't go for that much. Finally, Lamennais and Lacordaire decided that the best way to solve the whole problem was to go to Rome, to plead their case in Rome before the Pope. The Pope at the time was Gregory the 16th. It's about 1830. They go to Rome. They are convinced that the Pope is going to support them and support their movement. Their case is heard. They go home. They hear no word for a year or two. And in 1832, Pope Gregory XVI issues the encyclical Mirari Vos, in which he condemns the whole Lavenir project. The whole effort to reconcile God and liberty is just condemned. Lacordaire simply walks away. This is the will of God. I will do something else. Obedience of the church. Lamennais, who was willing to give everything for the Pope, who thought the Pope should be the head of Europe, says nothing to him. He doesn't go for this at all. And he begins a movement away from the church. Lacordaire begins a movement away from him. Lamennais becomes more and more radical as time goes on. And eventually, by the time he dies, it indicated that he did not want Christian burial. So this man, who was a complete ultramodernist, the Pope was everything, in the end, wants nothing to do with the church. Which you kind of could understand for a man who said his ordination was the worst day of his life. But anyway, Lacordaire goes on, and he's going to go back and live this quiet life as a chaplain. One of the things that is very important for Lacordaire throughout his life is a belief in providence. That God guides us. God has a plan for us, even if we don't know it. Now, I mention this at this point because Lacordaire never expected to be a great preacher. He never expected to restore a religious order. He never expected any of these things that we know him for. So anyway, he goes back, he's going to be a chaplain, and then about 1833, a man named Frederick Ozanam. Frederick Ozanam was a very important figure in 19th century France. We know him as the founder of the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Like Lacordaire, is very much committed to reconciliation of God and liberty. And he says they need somebody to preach these conferences for young people at a place called the Collège Stanislaus. And Lacordaire accepts this. And then later on, he's asked to preach these conferences at Notre Dame Cathedral, and he accepts those. In 1836, he abruptly stopped his preaching, and he went to Rome. And there are various reasons for this. One is that some of the priests were very critical of him and didn't think he was very well prepared, so he went to Rome to study. And during the course of that time in Rome, he decides to reestablish a religious order and eventually become the Dominican Order is the one he reestablishes. But he thinks that in order to re-evangelize France, Dominican priests can't do it. You need people who are full-time committed to this kind of re-evangelization that goes on. So that's why he restores the Dominican Order to re-evangelize his country, to re-evangelize France. In 1838, he writes an essay. It's called The Essay on the Reestablishment of the Order of Preachers in France. The Essay on the Reestablishment of the Order of Preachers in France. And the essay is intended for the French public. And the reason he has to do that is because it is illegal for religious orders to exist in France at that time. The government tended to allow orders of women, nursing sisters, and teaching sisters to exist. If you were teachers, they were more lenient. But if you were a friar or a monk, they especially didn't care much for you. You had almost no chance of being legally reconstituted. And this was because even at the time of the French Revolution, most people, even Catholics, even priests, did not really care much about the monks or the friars. And it was good riddance when they went out of existence. They were seen as kind of worthless. And the 18th century was not our best century to begin with. So it's kind of understandable why people just said, good, these people bought a lot of money. They don't really do much of anything. But anyway, Lacordaire wanted to restore the Dominicans. It's also interesting, too, he didn't look for any old Dominicans when he wanted to restore the Dominicans. He wanted to start from scratch. So yeah, he wrote this essay, which was very important in terms of winning public opinion over for the reestablishment of the order. He went to Rome for his formation and was professed as a Dominican, also did some theological studies in Rome. And he returned to France in 1841. Now his return is rather dramatic. He crosses the border in the French habit. He has this on, he has the cape and all of that. It's a big deal. Well, the big deal is that when he crosses over to France, he's doing an act that is illegal. You have no right to do that. He can be arrested immediately. But he doesn't stop there. He goes to the Cathedral of Notre Dame. He's invited to give a sermon. And the sermon is on the vocation of the French nation. And in that sermon, he very much identifies France with Catholicism. If France is to be a great nation, it has to be a Catholic nation. And seated before him at the cathedral at that point, the Archbishop of Paris, all kinds of government officials, no one would dare to arrest him. So this is a very important moment in the life of Lacordaire, in the life of France, in the life of the Dominican Order. Now, he spent the rest of the 1840s building new houses of the order in France, and really building up the order in France. And he becomes the provincial in 1850 when the order is restored in France. He continues to preach. In his 50s, his health fails. He works at a boys' school. He starts an order of teaching brothers. In 1861, he's elected to the French Academy in recognition of his oratory, in recognition of his writings, his letters, etc. And he dies in 1861, a little bit later, in that year when he was only 59 years old. So that, in a nutshell, is the life of Lacordaire. That's the brief biography. Now I want to talk about some principal themes that I've already alluded to some of them before. God and liberty is a basic theme that constantly comes across in everything that he does. Now, what is this God and liberty thing? It's the reconciliation of the church and the world that flowed from the French Revolution. Most 19th century French Catholics wanted no part of the world that flowed from the French Revolution. They wanted no part of liberty, equality, fraternity. They associated these things with a revolution that had tried to destroy the Catholic Church. And so they were somewhat hostile to this whole God and liberty thing. But Lacordaire said, you have to reconcile the two. that you have to accept the good that comes out of the French Revolution. In a sense, you baptize that which, this is very important for Lacordaire, you baptize that which can be used for the good of the church. You baptize the Romantic movement. You baptize liberty, fraternity, and equality, because these are helpful for evangelization. And so, accept this modern democratic society, accept these various freedoms, accept separation of church and state, because separation of church and state will allow the church to be truly free and autonomous. Before, when you had the union of church and state, which you had Gallicanism, and the church was in a real way very much restricted and restrained. And that's one of the reasons why ultramontanism is so attractive to Lacordaire, because it allows the church to be free. It allows the church not to be dependent on a particular government. So God and liberty is a very important theme in terms of understanding him. Another important theme, the French term aimer son temps, to love one's time. It's important to love one's time, to love one's society, to love one's century. It's a kind of romanticism, but it's not what we usually associate with romanticism. It's a romanticism of the moment. It's not a romanticism of the past. You look to the moment you live in. You don't look back to another time. You don't look back to the situation before the revolution. You don't look back to the Middle Ages. You simply look back to the time. You don't look back at all. You live in the time that you're in. You make the most of it and you evangelize that time. And he also applies this to his approach to Dominican life. When he's restoring the Dominican order, he makes it very clear. He's not a medievalist. He's not restoring some medieval institution because he loves the Middle Ages. But that's not why he chooses the Dominicans, because he thinks the Dominicans are best suited for the task of preaching in his time. They're best suited for the task of re-evangelizing France. And that's why he chooses them. Not because he has a lot of medieval customs, etc. So anyway, so that's it. God and liberty, and they sont temps. Another important theme, and this is what he says, this describes it. The supreme art is to know the force of the time in which one lives. The supreme art is to know the force of the time in which one lives. Now, if you're a 19th century French person, that means you have to understand the world that is rooted in liberty, equality, and fraternity. It means you have to understand a world that wants more democratic institutions. In order to speak to people of that time, you have to understand that. You can't speak from a perspective of another time and place. That's why he says the supreme art is to know the force of the time in which one lives. Now, Lacordaire has a very dynamic, organic understanding of history and tradition, similar to John Henry Newman. John Henry Newman is a brilliant theologian who's able to articulate his theory of development. Lacordaire is not a systematic thinker. He's not a speculative thinker. He's much more a man of action. And in all of his actions, you see this very dynamic, organic understanding of history and tradition. When he talks about restoration, whether he's talking about restoration of Catholicism in France, or whether he's talking about restoration of the Dominican order, he means renewal. He means recreation. He means reinvigoration. And once again, these things are unusual for 19th century French Catholicism. 19th century French Catholicism was not interested in a dynamic understanding of renewal at all, but Lacordaire was. 19th century French Catholicism, for the most part, was not interested in knowing one's time, or aimer son temps, or that whole particular perspective, but he was. There were many, many religious communities that were founded in the 19th century. Many were refounded in the 19th century. But Lagrange is rather unique because so many of those communities, in a sense, even though they had modern ministries and apostolates, they looked to the past for most of their ideals, for most of their vision. Whereas with Lagrange, you get a Catholic who actually looks to the present moment for his particular vision and his particular moving ideal for what he wants to do. Okay, now I want to talk about some specific aspects of Lagrange's preaching. Some specific aspects. Now I'm going to go back a bit. I said earlier that his preaching career really begins in 1833 with Frederick Ozanam's suggestion. It's an act of providence. He hadn't planned on it, but he felt this is what God was calling him to do. Ozanam wanted somebody to give him conferences to some high school kids. Lagrange was especially concerned for the welfare of young people, for their spiritual welfare. But a funny thing happened. These conferences started in January of 1834. And they started with high school boys. And within about 2 months, the young people had been completely replaced by adults. In about 2 months, instead of these kids, you had people like Victor Hugo, Chateaubriand, all kinds of literary people who were frankly fighting to get into these talks, to listen to these sermons. And the thing that they don't quite understand is this. We don't expect a priest, a Catholic priest, to sound like us. We don't expect the Catholic priest to know about liberty or the ideals of the French Revolution. We don't expect the Catholic priest to know what it's like not to be a believer. We just don't expect the Catholic priest to sound like Lagrange. And so they want to hear more. Now, Lagrange didn't come up with this just on the top of his head. As I said before, he had spent years of prayer and study. And he never gave a sermon without prayer and study. It's always very important for him. And his apology for Christianity in France very much was based on the idea that Catholicism comes from God. And Catholicism is essential to the renewal of society. If you want to renew France, you have to be Catholic. He became, even before he became a Dominican, he very much lived the Dominican motto, which is contemplata alias tradere, to contemplate and to share the fruits of that contemplation with others. To contemplate and to share the fruits of that contemplation with others. And this was always his approach. You pray before you preach. You read before you preach. You read the Bible. You read St. Augustine. You read St. Thomas. You read the fathers of the church. You read the great theologians. You're always prepared. It's very important for him. But then his preaching departed from some of the customary ways of preaching at the time. Now, there were 17th century rules for preaching in France that come from Bishop Bossuet. And these rules were rather rigid. And priests who preached that way often found congregations very bored. And nobody was coming. Now, when he was young, Lagrange used to write out his sermons. And somebody once said that this man is never going to become a great orator. This man doesn't have what it takes to be a preacher. Then he decided, once he started giving those talks to the College Stanislaus, not to write anything down. Because he said it would take away from the power of his oratory. Once again, even though he didn't write anything down, that doesn't mean he just started preaching off the cuff and just talked. And these things were elaborately thought out in his head. Now, the only reason we have his sermons is because even though he didn't write anything down, other people did. And then they would submit these sermons to him for his approval. And he would say, yes, this is what I wrote. So that's how we actually have his sermons. He preached brilliant sermons, which profoundly moved his listeners because of his eloquence, his enthusiasm, and his faith. His listeners saw him not simply as a priest, but as a poet, a philosopher, a compatriot, and a contemporary, who spoke to people of his time in a dynamic way about a religion that they thought was dying. They thought Catholicism was dying, if not dead. And here's a man speaking of Catholicism as if it's a living, vibrant thing. His listeners were impressed not just by his oratorical skills, but after a while they were impressed by what he was actually saying. And they listened to what he was saying about God, what he was saying about the church. Now, these co-ed status law sermons were very successful, but then there were certain of the priests, his fellow diocesan priests, who started complaining, he's not following the Bossuet rules, he's not properly educated, he's not qualified for this. They go to the archbishop and complain, so the archbishop decides that he's going to remove him, he stops the conferences. Meanwhile, they need people for the conference in 1835 at Notre Dame Cathedral, which was a very prestigious thing. Now, they had seven priests who were doing this, doing the thing, and it was a disaster. One was more boring than the other. Nobody was coming. It just wasn't working at all. And so people would come to the archbishop. Even students from the College of Status Law says, give it to Lacordaire. Let Lacordaire preach these sermons. The archbishop decided he's going to do that. So we let him do it. The cathedral was packed. People would line up for hours and hours just to get into the cathedral to hear him. Once again, his listeners were captivated by this child of the age, by this 19th century priest who liked them, who loved the ideals of the French Revolution, especially liberty, who loved the time and century in which he lived, and who spoke in a romantic language, a language of the heart that they understood. Unbelievers in the congregation knew that he understood their unbelief because he had struggled with unbelief as a young man. In his preaching, Lacordaire discussed the social issues of the time, and he said that Christianity is the only adequate solution to these very social problems. He used an apologetic of freedom in talking to his listeners. He said that freedom is so important for you. It's your highest value. Freedom does not ultimately come from the French Revolution. Freedom comes from God. God created us free. Jesus Christ died in order that we might be free. The only way you can be free is to be a Catholic Christian. He also used this somewhat nationalistic apologetic too. He said that you want to be French. You emphasize being French and the importance of being French. He says if you're going to be truly French, you have to be a Catholic Christian. Because France, its culture and its civilization can only be understood in the context of its Catholic history. Catholicism hasn't formed the nation. Catholicism has informed the civilization, the culture of France. Without the church, there would be no France as we know it. Now, it's important to emphasize at this point, Lacordaire did not uncritically accept his age. He did not uncritically accept the values, the ideas of the French Revolution, or these other values people had. He always thought you have to look at them from the perspective of the gospel. yes, you need to understand the people that you're speaking to, but that doesn't mean that you uncritically accept what they believe in. You challenge them, and you challenge them from the perspective of the gospel. It's very important for him. But he said that, when I became a Christian, I did not lose sight of the world. If you're going to speak to the world, you have to make it very clear that you know the world, and you understand the world. So that's why he says, when I became a Christian, I didn't lose sight of the world. Lacordaire continued to preach until his health failed. And at this point, I was going to tell the Curie Barre story, but Father Rogers already told him. It's very nice. So I'll just sort of come to an end at this point by saying, like Lacordaire in the 19th century, may we, the preachers of the 21st century, not lose sight of the world. May we love liberty. May we love our century. May we seek to know the force of the time in which we live. And may we preach to the people of our day the timeless truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thank you.
Plenty of time for questions.
Yes. Quick question. If during Lacordaire's time, Romanticism was the language of the day,
right.
What do you think Lacordaire would think of our present day? What is the language of the present day? Science or anything else?
Science had been the language of his time too, but science was unable to solve a lot of the problems. And so there was this turn to the heart, and you know, that's what really that represented. The language of our time.
Emotivism? Emotivism?
Could be, yeah. It's not science, I don't think. I have to be quite honest, I don't think it is science.
Technology.
Technology.
Technology, yeah, very much so, I think so.
Convenience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
Father. Could you identify similar themes or similar currents of thinking or sequence of thinking that run through, and feel free to add to this list, someone like Philip Neri, Lacordaire, Acton, Antonio Rosmini.
It's too much, Father.
Is it? these are people.
I know these
Hecker,
people.
Isaac Hecker.
No, okay. Isaac Hecker is better. No, it's only because I once thought about like writing my doctoral dissertation. Hecker and Lacordaire. In some ways,
Newman, all these liberals.
Newman especially. Hecker is a kind of American Lacordaire, in my opinion, because he's a romantic, and he comes out of that whole transcendentalism, which was a romantic movement. And he, in a sense, he thinks that Catholicism is the answer to the redemption of American society. So it's very, very similar. Preaching is very important for Hecker. So I would see Hecker is very, very similar in many ways to the Lacordaire. Newman also comes out of the same kind of sort of a romantic recovery of religion. When we think of romanticism and religion in the 19th century, we often think of a kind of nature religion. But there was a whole Catholic aspect to it, and it's especially in France. And authority was very much a part of it, but many people were captivated by the beauty of Catholicism, by the beauty of the Catholic tradition, the beauty of the sacraments, etc. Especially Chateaubriand played a big role in that. And so I would say Newman is a romantic in a similar way, you know, and doesn't just speak, you know, from the head. The heart is also involved, and it's very different to say neo-scholasticism. So I would say Newman and Hecker have very much in common. I don't know enough about Rosmini. Yeah.
What did you think of The Liberal That Failed? Is that the book on Lacordaire? You don't know it?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'll get you there.
Okay,
you'll
tell me about that.
No, I want you to tell me.
is it by an English person?
No, it's an American, maybe a Jesuit, what's his name? It'll come to me.
Okay, I'm very interested
in
that.
It's out of print now.
Okay.
I have a copy, I'll send
it. Oh, okay, thank you, Father.
Do you,
Do you think he was a saint? And if not, what would be the argument against him being considered a saint?
Okay, I don't exactly know why he is not a subject of a canonization. I've asked French Dominicans. No one seems to have a real answer as to what's going on here. What I would suggest is that in the 19th century with the Restoration, one of the early recruits for Lacordaire is a man named Alexandre Jandel. Jandel early on decides that he does not agree with Lacordaire's interpretation of the order. He decides that Lacordaire's ideas on observance are not strict enough. Jandel very much wants to restore what he sees as the medieval customs of the order. Lacordaire very much says preaching is what we're called to do, and so let any of our observances have to be adjusted to the preaching. Now, Lacordaire is no lax. Sometimes, okay, well, there's a big controversy called over the midnight office. Now, Jandel says that the Dominicans should get up at midnight in order to pray. But there was some kind of, I guess, 17th century change, or so they said that midnight could be any time up to 3 in the morning. Lacordaire says, no, that's not good, because the fathers are counseling people, they're often up late at night, and they need 8 hours of sleep. Even in the Middle Ages, the Cistercians were allowed 8 hours of sleep. So let's do 4 o'clock in the morning. So he says 4 o'clock. So they have this great fight. Well, then, by then, Jandel is the master general of the order. So he gets the last word. So there's been a sort of a continuing struggle in the order, which even to this day goes on between those who follow Lacordaire and those who follow Jandel. So, given that kind of situation, it would be very hard to choose to pursue one cause without the other. Personally, I think Lacordaire was a very holy man, and I think he probably is a saint. I'm not aware of anything that would, speak against that. I mean, he was very prayerful. He had some rather odd penances, which I will go into, which are generally not publicized. They're written down, but I mean, you just think that we would say are probably psychologically bad. But he wanted to humiliate. For example, okay, we'll look at the milder ones. He carried a cross around with him, a big cross that he would drag around with him, to different places. And before preaching, he would hang on the cross for a few hours or so as a way of humbling himself, because, so all this adulation would go to his head. Now, these are things that were not talked about for a long period of time. Now they're talked about sometimes, and there are other odd things. So maybe even that has something to do with it. I don't know.
I was going to bring up, it was maybe in the new one, but I understood that he used disciplines before preaching.
That was
one of the things that he did.
Yeah, he did. And
in order to prepare himself to.
Right. And there's also weird stuff. I probably should, because it'll give you the wrong idea. But for example.
Oh, some of us think it's great.
Okay. There's one story. Okay, say you're at your desk, and Lacordaire eventually says, "I'm going to lie at your desk. Would you kick me?" And the provincial is there, and a lot of people would like to kick their provincials. And you kick him. But of course, there was the whipping and that sort of thing. So he did do those, but he never talked. In a sense, it doesn't fit in with the public persona, because he never talked about these things. In the 19th century, in France, there was a great emphasis on reparation. Reparation for the sins of the revolution. Saint Macarius is an example of that. But Lacordaire doesn't seem to fall into that category. He never talks, never mentions any of this. But for personal reasons, for whatever reason, he's doing this. So that's...
Father, what was it about the Dominicans that he was attracted to, since he didn't have a necessarily religious past growing up, as you said, and with all the different other orders that were suppressed during the Revolution, why not like the Sulpicians or the Vincentius? I mean, why did he particularly go to the Dominicans?
Okay, it probably was not his idea. Dominicans and Benedictines for many years kind of quarreled over this. Labrador was making a retreat at Salem, it seems. And Don Galonger, who had restored the Benedictine order, suggested to Labrador that he might consider restoring the Dominican order, that the Dominican order was very important. And Labrador read the constitutions and he liked it. Don Garonger, when he wrote his essay on the reestablishment, didn't like the fact that Labrador apologized for the Inquisition, because Garonger said that was our proudest moment. But so I think that's what comes from Garonger, because he had no experience. He was at first considering the Jesuits, and the Jesuits wanted him, but then somehow he was introduced to the Dominicans and read the constitutions, and it seemed that this was exactly one of the things he liked about the Dominican constitutions, was that there was a freedom involved there. The Dominicans, we have this freedom of dispensation, that the important thing is the preaching. And so there can be dispensation in order to make the preaching more effective. That very much appealed to this whole emphasis that he had on liberty. And I don't think the Jesuits would have had the same appeal to him at all. So I think that's it.
Just maybe a few more comments on the local clergy. Like his goal was to sort of reform the order, reform France.
Right.
You know, and the local clergy just couldn't do it.
Right.
What's going on there? I guess, you know, that it seemed to have to be a religious or a special group to really focus on recovery, renewal, transformation.
Right. Well, to some extent, I think the local clergy had their parishes to take care of. They weren't trained for preaching. They didn't have the inclination to preach. There was also a problem with Gallicanism, too, involving local clergy. Ultramontanism, in some ways, was a salvation. It gave a wider view of church than many local clergy, because of Gallicanism, had a very narrow view of the church that was sort of confined to France. You know, I think the religious order gave a wider vision, you know, and preaching was the purpose. That's what you do. The French Dominicans did not then and never have had parishes at all. Thank you. You preach. You evangelize in various different ways. So I think that was really the thing. And the local clergy were attached to their one little parish, etc. And they just didn't have that kind of enthusiasm, really. Yes.
I was wondering about the whole controversy with Mararibos, and it sounds like he just kept going and talking about liberty, fraternity, equality, but he was never censured or anything.
No, okay, yeah, he said that he was an impenitent liberal, and he never apologized for being a liberal. He accepted the fact that he had to keep silence, that he could no longer be part of the Lavenir movement, but in a sense, he never apologized for being a liberal. He never gave up being a liberal. So interiorly, he always was a liberal. Mm-hmm. But unlike Lamennais, he can accept the Vatican says, you can't talk about this, you can't write about this, that he was obedient. Whereas Lamennais was so caught up in his own pride, in his own fascination with his own ideas, that he could not make that kind of submission.
What counsels do you think Lacordaire would have for priests today, specifically with religious freedom in the United States?
Okay, that's a very difficult question. I always find it difficult. He would say it's important to emphasize the need for the church to be free, the need for the church not to be under various restrictive kind of policies of government. I think he would have wanted the church to not be so dependent on the government either, perhaps. The autonomy of the church is the important thing. don't look to the government in a sense to do your work for you, you know.
And did he ground the structure of his preaching fundamentally in sacred scripture, the fathers, etc., or did he ground? I've only read a couple of his homilies, or did he ground it more or less in the mentality and the philosophy of those he was trying to persuade?
I would probably say it's kind of a combination of the two, yeah, because it's very much scripture plays a part. Thomas doesn't come into play early on. Thomas comes into play once he becomes a Dominican, and he studies Thomas, and so later on Thomas comes into play, like in those trip to Notre Dame conferences, you don't really hear Thomas much at all. But so I think he was using scriptures as he would have understood it. I think we would find a lot of his use of scriptures somewhat defective now. But also it's very important for him to be able to speak to the people of his time and to make Christianity, I wouldn't say it so much make it attractive to people of the time, but at least make it comprehensible to people of the time.
Translating.
I mean, I don't think he's trying to compromise or water down at all. But I think he's just trying to make it, you know, translated so that people of his time can understand and appreciate it. Yes.
It's my opinion that in the United States, the liberty movement is perhaps on its ascendancy. Is liberty, that idea of liberty, properly understood, really a middle ground where the church can really engage people these days? Sort of like Lacordaire engaged the whole ideals of the revolution. It seems to me like everything, you can think about all the things that we hate, but everything seems to be predicated on this idea of freedom. Is that someplace that for our preaching, you think we can engage people, or is it toxic?
I don't see it as being very successful. I mean, we haven't gotten anywhere so far with that.
Have we tried?
I don't know. Father, you look like you might
have
talked about that.
I'll save it for later.
So far, it seems that it doesn't go anywhere. He said that's just my own impression. You know, that we've just reached a point in our society when it just doesn't go anywhere. So in that sense, it's rather different than I think 19th century France was. Yes?
Would you connect him to the... You talked a lot about revival, renewal. Would you connect him to the Ressourcement?
Ressourcement is later. It's much more 20th century.
Was that born in some connection? Anyway, connected to his ideas?
Okay, one of the things that I want to talk about, I want to write about, is I see him as a kind of prophet of the Second Vatican Council, especially some of the ideas. And those ideas come through the French Dominicans, who play a very great role in terms of Ressourcement. And people like Congar often will make reference to their indebtedness to Lacordaire. Not so much the, they don't quote Lacordaire, but the spirit of Lacordaire very much influences French Dominicans. And so people like Lagrange and Congar and Chenu are very much see themselves as inheritors of his particular vision. It's more a vision than something that you can put your fingers on very clearly. But much of the intellectual and spiritual vitality of the Dominican Order, not just in France, but up until the Second Vatican Council, I believe comes from Lacordaire. So in that sense, the Ressourcement would very much be related to some of the approaches that he took. But I mean, it wouldn't be something that would directly, that he would have been involved with, but I think it comes later.